All right, Constant listeners, this is Nick Deolius. It is time for another episode, number 42 of the Far Middle Podcast. Episode 42 dedication, probably the least surprising of all, maybe outside of episode 23 with Michael Jordan, considering that every major league team has already retired this individual's number, and that, of course, is the great Jackie Robinson. So I don't think there's any need to state the often covered Jackie Robinson story. You know all the details with respect to it. But I tried to find and maybe point out a couple of things maybe you didn't know about Jackie Robinson, and I found four of them that I think were of particular interest. First one, Jackie Robinson grew up in Pasadena in California, and the best way I could describe his upbringing was he grew up poor in pretty much an affluent area. And because of sort of that dynamic, there were a couple of opportunities for him to turn out for the worst, to sort of take the wrong track in life. But of course he didn't. He chose the right track and he ended up at UCLA as a young man, which brings me to my second interesting sort of fact or facet of Jackie Robinson's life. When he was at UCLA, he lettered in four sports. He played baseball, football, track, and basketball. And ironically, track, I think, was his best sport. He was an NCAA champion in track. But guess what his worst sport was? Clearly it was baseball. He played only 1 year at UCLA in baseball, and his batting average that year was under 100, which maybe it's exceptional, but it's exceptional in a bad way. So he didn't exactly light it up on the diamond when he was at UCLA. Third interesting fact about Jackie Robinson, you know, he served his time in the military, so he's a veteran. And when he was in the military, he faced a court-martial. And this really revolved around an incident of him riding on a bus, either on the base or close to the base he was assigned to, and refusing to sit in the back of the bus. So he took a stand with respect to that. And in the end, fortunately, he was acquitted by a tribunal. But that was another interesting little detail of his life and career that I was not aware of. I didn't know if you were or not. And then the fourth and final interesting note about Jackie Robinson pertains to what he did after his playing career. He became the first African-American vice president of a major U.S. corporation. It was chock full of nuts. So that's another sort of accolade or accomplishment that Jackie Robinson was able to attain. Definitely, you know, the most interesting of sports and iconic figures for a lot of reasons. But episode 42, easy dedication here, Jackie Robinson. This fallacy or myth that portfolios that ideologically exclude investments like natural gas or oil in their portfolios, that they can consistently outperform and deliver returns on a consistent basis to portfolios that are not constrained. It reminds me of a Milton Friedman speech where he said that myths are like air mattresses. They're filled with nothing. They're pleasant to lay your head on, and they provide a very unpleasant disruptive jolt when they're deflated. The zero carbon economy, fossil fuel divestment to outperform on portfolio returns, these climate change policies creating value, those are all myths that are about to deliver a massive societal jolt as they are being deflated before our very eyes. They're being exposed. And there's another myth that's delivering a jolt as it deflates, and that is that climate change policy is going to improve our geopolitical standing and weaken our adversaries. Remember that myth that's been propagated? Guess what? Just the opposite is occurring. We punish domestic natural gas and oil through climate change policies. That makes us more energy dependent on others. It raises commodity and energy prices, and then it then helps the revenues and economies of places like Russia and Iran, who keep producing oil and natural gas, and it helps China as government mandates unreliable wind and solar that's going to have to be mined and made in places like China. Now, all that dynamic that I just described, it emboldens our adversaries. Russia is economically strengthened. It knows that Europe is weakened by all this, and it knows that Europe depends on Russian natural gas and oil to function. So somebody like Putin, he knows he can take Ukraine whenever he wants to, and he does so knowing that Europe and the United States have no long-term leverage against him as long as we're going to continue to kneel at that climate change altar. No energy independence, no leverage. It's just that simple. And it doesn't stop with Eastern Ukraine. So, you know, look out, all of Ukraine. Look out, Eastern Europe. Look out, Baltic states, Taiwan, Israel, and so on. It will, I fear, become a common topic for episodes to come on the Far Middle. And I lay a lot of the blame, if not all of the blame, at the feet of the environmentalists, the government bureaucrats, the left, and all these rent-seeking corporations that are, again, are propagating the church of climate change. In picking up that theme of the left, no example since the Russian Revolution over 100 years ago that you'll find out there of when the left gets into power where they're going to allow dissent and open debate. It just hasn't happened because it's something that that the left is frankly allergic to. And unfortunately, the United States and Canada in 2022, they're another pair of data points in that lineage. It's showing once again that as the left gains power in our country and in Canada, dissent, open debate, those are becoming rarer and rarer things. And one example of this that we can discuss is talking about these climate warriors and this obsession with climate change in the capital markets, and that myth that had been created that excluding fossil fuel investments and doubling down on so-called ESG-worthy investments will deliver superior returns from a portfolio versus one that's not screening under such an arbitrary criteria. And that's sort of been the myth that's been propagated out there without any backup of data. And the elite who are playing with our retirements and our investments and our savings dollars to basically exert their views on energy policy to the markets instead of focusing on what they should be obsessing about, which is risk-adjusted returns to protect future payments and investments of their beneficiaries, well, now you're seeing some interesting results come in, but you're not hearing enough about that. So this is a theme that I've discussed in the past on the Far Middle podcast. I discuss it extensively in my upcoming book, Precipice, The Left's Campaign to Destroy America. And it's a failure and breach of fiduciary duty, I believe, by entities like public pension managers and investment houses and portfolio managers. When this is occurring, it's a breach of duty. Investors, workers, those paying into the plans, retirees, depending on the plan, they have been much too complacent. And that has to end because it's now starting to cost you some serious dollars. And frankly, it could be putting your financial future at risk. You've got a big vested interest in making sure this is getting handled correctly and consistent with the duties of all. So what are those trends that I'm referencing in the markets of recent note? Well, one, the S&P is down. It's in fact in correction territory. And due in large part, it's down because of dumb energy policy that's stoking inflation, that's creating supply chain woes, and it, of course, is creating geopolitical stressors, as we've seen with what's going on with Russia and Ukraine. The S&P is basically, as I said, in correction territory. But the NASDAQ is down for the same reasons and even worse shape than the S&P. By the way, ESG green baskets, so to speak, they are down. And you don't see a lot of ink being expended on pointing that out when you read the financial press. S&P Energy, way up. Exxon, just as an example of S&P Energy or the Dow Energy components, Exxon's up 80% over the past year. Just about any commodity that you can think of, so that includes, of course, oil and natural gas, they're way up. Oil broke through $100 a barrel with the recent moves that Russia made on invading Ukraine. Gasoline in Los Angeles hit $6 a gallon recently because of all these issues that we're talking about. So if you're an investment fund, if you are a pension, or if you're somebody else that's allocating dollars for returns, and you're shunning or divesting of energy or carbon or fossil fuel, you just ended up costing your sort of beneficiaries or the people that you're supposed to be looking after and your clients who knows how many hundreds of billions of dollars of return. But someone, I think, should run the calculations to try to quantify how bad this type of behavior has resulted in loss of value and then start asking questions to hold those that are in control of these investments accountable for their dereliction of duty. And I mentioned Canada Trudeau because I got a lot of questions about this Canadian trucker protest from listeners and from others in different circles. What are my thoughts? Well, when it comes to the Canadian trucker protest, I do have a number of thoughts. And I'll start with the first one, which is that pandemic government constraints, they have been grossly, with a capital G, heavy-handed. These constraints, they did not help stop the spread. They did not save lives, and they were net killers when you look at the data objectively. They were killers of everything from economies to lives to the educational acumen of kids, and frankly, they were killers of quality of life. and on top of it, individual liberty. Unfortunately, we, the citizenry, were largely sheep throughout the entire process. Second thought that I've got with the Canadian trucker protests is that things like vaccine mandates, they are a substantial violation of personal liberty. So despite my being pro-vaccine, which I am also staunchly anti-vaccine mandate. So whether it's the United States or Canada, through government, they should not be able to dictate that truckers or whoever be vaccinated. That is not government's role in a republic or a democracy. And then the third thought I've got is that rule of law matters. Now that sounds simple, but that is something that's completely missed today, the more and more that that you look at it. So you might be right on an issue morally, and you might have a right to be angry about that issue, but that does not give somebody the right to assault or loot or burn or block or disrupt others. Society requires a level of decorum and behavior that's going to respect the ability of others to function and make a living. So maybe, call it more of an MLK approach to protest that I'm advocating for. But what you see today are much more violent, disruptive strands in society. That's not a good thing. Fourth, views like the ones I laid out, I think that they should be held fast and consistent. So it's not whether you're looking at a Democrat or a Republican issue of the moment, or whether it's big or small, or whether it's Canada or the United States, or liberal or conservative. You can't or shouldn't be able to pick and choose when you apply these principles. They should be held consistent. And I think too often today, principles are applied haphazardly, and they're applied inconsistently based on what the political views or the whims or the circumstances are of whether you agree or disagree with the issue of the day. Consistency in the end, in the rigor of consistency, it crystallizes thinking. So that's a good thing. We should embrace it. Fifth thought I had on this is the government, and particularly the left, they will take any issue and use it as an opportunity to extend and exert power. That's what Trudeau did. He made a trucker protest over a vaccine mandate look like the outbreak of civil war. He was freezing bank accounts like the truckers were terrorists, and his heavy-handed actions made things much worse. It actually helped the cause of the very entity he was trying to outwit. So he proved sort of a dimwit here instead, and now he's stuck with his actions, and he's in a bit of a corner. So I guess that all means that I'm sympathetic to the truckers. I agree with their position, but I do not agree with their methods of stopping life and commerce. And I don't think Trudeau made things better with his response. He obviously made things worse, but it was a typical response to be expected from someone when they're coming from elite, insulated bureaucratic states or bureaucratic organisms that have a habit of embracing the left. Now, if Jackie Robinson is the most interesting of sports figures in the sports world, let's jump to our next thought to discuss, which is a not very interesting sports event of late. And that is sort of my views coming off of the closing of the now 22 Winter Beijing Olympics. Didn't watch a single minute of it. I have to state that at the start. That's the first time in my life or adult life that I've not watched any of a summer or a winter set of Olympic games. And, one reason, of course, that I didn't watch a single minute of it was it wasn't really compelling. There wasn't, at least to me, it didn't appear that there were any sort of major storylines going in. But also, I have to admit that a big part of my not watching the Olympics or tuning in at all was because of principle. And I do consider the recent Winter Games to be the genocide games. And I think it's interesting to look at China and how they learned and evolved from the Summer Games, if you remember, that were held in Beijing once again as far back as 2008. It's hard to believe it was back as in 2008 where those Summer Games were held in Beijing. Now that we're looking at wrapping up the Winter Games in Beijing in 22. But back in 08, the Chinese Communist Party officials had some interesting views going into those Summer Games. One thing that they said was that, quote, by allowing Beijing to host the Games, you will help the development of human rights, end quote. I thought that was an interesting sort of pitch that the Chinese Communist Party was making to secure those Summer Games in 08. They also went on record saying that the Games were an opportunity to foster democracy. That's their words. How did that turn out over the past, what would it be, 14 years since the 2008 Summer Games in Beijing? And many might not remember this, but when I referenced the 22 Winter Beijing Games as the genocide games, I was borrowing that tagline from, of all people, Mia Farrow, the actress, when she used that term for the 08 Summer Games over China's support of a dictator, an African dictator, I want to say it was in Sudan. She pressured, I also think she pressured Steven Spielberg, who was originally given the opportunity to produce the videos for the games going into the summer 08 Beijing games. And I believe he actually sort of backed down from producing those videos in part because of Mia Farrow's pressure and her tagging those games, the genocide games, and saying, why would you want to be a part of that and help promote that based on what the host country is supporting and propagating. Also, with those 08 summer games in Beijing, Xi, at the time, was tasked with running those games. He really cut his teeth, made his name on those summer 08 games when he came to international prominence. And now, of course, he is president for life in China. Now, for the 22 winter games also held in Beijing, China this time around did not have to worry about making all those false promises about democracy and being good for human rights and the like. The New York Times itself rightfully noted, and I thought this was a great point, got to give credit where credit is due, even if it's giving credit to the New York Times, but they said that China then sought to meet the world's terms, you know, referencing the 08 Summer Games. Now, in terms of the 22 Winter Games, the world has to accept China's terms. And I thought that was a really good insight from the New York Times. And how we're dealing, or how we dealt with the 22 Winter Games and what's going on with China and the oppression that the Chinese Communist Party is manifesting, well, once again, we in the Biden administration look quite weak. Instead of sitting out this ridiculous charade of humankind coming together, right, for companionship and competition and facing it for what it is, instead we decide to take that strong move of not sending diplomats or government representatives to the games. I mean, really, is that going to have any sort of an impact? It's almost as if we'd be better off not doing anything. It was such a weak, sort of hollow move that it almost made us look comical. And that, of course, is not a good thing, especially in today's world. And then the closing ceremony, again, I didn't see this, so I can't speak to it directly, but I heard that the closing ceremony, they had a globe that was rolled across basically a sea of cracking ice, right? And as the globe rolled across the ice and it was cracking as it rolled through it, it was making the point of a fragile planet. Are those climate change references? Is that our Code Red for Humanity reference? Yep. Yeah, so we got, you know, fake globe, fake ice, a fake crowd effectively because of how they staged the crowds and everything going on with quarantines and shutdowns in China. All of it making a point of a hype topic so that what? So that the host country, China, they can instigate the left and environmentalists in the West to keep pushing these destructive climate change policies that benefit China and hurt the Western democracies. I did see something that was pretty funny. I can't remember where I saw it exactly, but they were poking fun at the Olympic Committee recently and the whole selection process. They said that the next games are going to be decided with respect to location. They're down to the short list. And the short list that they said the Olympic Committee was down to was North Korea, Iran, and Canada, I guess making a reference to how our Justin Trudeau is becoming quite the despot and dictator. And just to show you how this obsession about CO2 concentrations in 50 years in the atmosphere, coupled with the policies, the damaging policies that go with it, are completely making our world a worse place, I got to go to our climate czar. I'm trying to be respectful here, but our climate czar, John Kerry, the week that Russia invaded Ukraine, literally, I think it was the day of, John Kerry goes on record with the media. And he had a couple of statements that I almost fell out of my chair when I read them. But it really does sum up how messed up, how screwed up our priorities have become with respect to things that truly matter versus things that are way, way down the list. So the first statement that I came across, and again, it almost defies logic that he would have said that, but John Kerry warned that Russia's war against the Ukraine could distract the world from the climate change crisis and produce what he deemed massive emissions that will negatively impact the globe. So we got Ukrainians being murdered and the country of Ukraine being eradicated, And while those tanks are rolling across the border, our climate czar is worried about what the emission footprint is going to be of the invasion. It just shows you how ridiculous things have become in these circles. The other quote that he had that was almost more shocking to me, and I'm going to quote her to get it right. He said, "And the people of Russia are at risk. And so I hope President Putin will help us stay on track with respect to what we do or what we need to do for the climate." So his message to Putin, and this is a prior head diplomat for the United States under the Obama administration, his view is that we need to make sure that Putin and Russia stay on track with respect to these climate accords and climate change policies. Let's not pay as much attention to what he's doing today with respect to the Ukraine. Pretty hard to believe, but those are quotes coming from our climate czar, John Kerry. And while he's out there doing that, the Biden administration in D.C., they're making things worse on their own, but in their own special way. So again, literally while Putin is massing troops to jump into the Ukraine, the Biden administration and bureaucrats in that administration and the FERC were making it more unlikely the United States pipelines are going to be approved and be built in the future. So we are hard at work in D.C. stymieing our own energy infrastructure. There was a 3-2 decision from FERC. It was along sort of party lines that gave more weight to environmental concerns of new pipeline projects. And it also decided on that vote to take greenhouse gas emissions of the pipeline into consideration. So this vote basically said that FERC now needs to consider upstream and downstream greenhouse gas impacts of pipelines, which makes it extremely subjective and wide open to bureaucratic interpretation. So what do you think is going to happen, right? You don't have to be a genius to figure this out. So this is eventually, because pipelines are the conduits for all kinds of energy infrastructure that is necessary and vital, this is eventually going to impact liquefied natural gas facilities, where we can export our natural gas to countries like Germany, like Europe, as a continent that will make it have the ability to create some energy independence, which will then give it more backbone when dealing with entities like Russia. So LNG sort of being America's secret aircraft carrier fleet when it comes to geopolitical leverage, that's going to be completely eradicated down the road with this very subjective sort of standard that the FERC has now created to basically kill any pipeline project that a bureaucrat wants to kill. And the chairman of FERC said these moves are going to create more clarity for projects. It's unbelievable how bureaucrats can make short work of the truth. He knows what this is all about, but chose to warrant it as something completely different. And again, I'm trying to be respectful, trying to be nice here. Now, the reality is it's going to purposely create legal uncertainty that is going to chill needed energy infrastructure investment. And while our president is stumbling on sound bites with Putin at these silly sort of stage press conferences, his regulators are making energy dependence and geopolitical leverage worse at the same time. With all the turmoil and sort of idiotic moves, logic that's being applied in the world today, came across the second watch of a movie. I saw the first watch for me was when the movie originally came out a number of years ago, but timely today. And I don't know if it's a good idea or a bad idea to give it a watch today. It might be a worse in terms of your state of mind. But Book of Eli, really good movie that I think resonates more today than ever. First, the acting in it is exceptional. You got Denzel Washington. I don't think Denzel Washington ever puts out a bad movie. He's always great in all of his different roles. And you also got Gary Oldman in that movie. And Gary Oldman is one of these, I don't know, comes across to me as like an extreme actor, method actor, sort of extreme roles. I don't know what he's like, off the movie set, but he's always a pretty dynamic, interesting actor to boot. So the two of them did an awesome job in the Book of Eli. But the irony that I'm watching this movie, and of course the whole premise of it is that Eli is trying to get this book, right, that is precious to him, to California. He ends up landing in San Francisco on Alcatraz, and he's basically on this quest to deliver the book through these barren lands and dangerous areas and regions of the western United States. He needs to get to San Francisco, to California, so knowledge and thought could be preserved for all to consume, right, for all to enjoy in future generations. What's ironic about all this is today, okay, if this was sort of my objective, the last place I would try to head toward with such a book to, say, preserve free thought or to preserve individual liberty would be California or San Francisco. So I thought it was pretty ironic that that was like the end objective, and he's doing everything in his power to get there on this quest. But today I'd almost be on a quest to get as far away from California and San Francisco I could, if again free thought and individual liberty were at stake. But a good movie, and if you haven't seen it in a while or never had a chance to view it, check out Book of Eli. And that's going to wrap up episode 42 of the Far Middle Podcast. I'm going to leave and conclude you with a note, a belated happy birthday. I think it was very early March where the birthday occurred, of Robert Conrad, the great actor. And I've always, you know, loved Robert Conrad since I was a kid, watching TV as a kid. And I sort of boil my liking his work to three sort of items. One, the Wild Wild West. That series on TV, I used to watch the reruns of it as a kid, was awesome. You had Secret Service agent James T. West that Robert Conrad portrayed in the series. This was a series in the late 60s. I'd love the introduction cut and the scenes after you would go to the end of each scene before commercial break, where you would have it then painted into the corner for that episode of the opening sort of frame. And I love the gadgetry that was in that series, almost like a James Bond type, Q type set of gadgetry that that was equipped on the train that they traveled on or with the agents themselves. I love the villains in that series. Dr. Lovelace was an awesome actor as well as an awesome character in that series. And Robert Conrad did his own stunts on the Wild Wild West. In fact, he almost died performing one of those stunts where he fell 12 foot on his head and had to be taken to a hospital post-haste. But he did his own stunts on that series. The second sort of body of work that I love with Robert Conrad was what he did on Baa Baa Black Sheep, another sort of TV series that I was an avid watcher of when I was a kid. This was about the World War II Pacific Fighter Squadron. This series, I think, was filmed probably in the mid-late 70s, so it came after the Wild Wild West. Pappy Boyington was the character that Robert Conrad played, just an awesome job with Baa Baa Black Sheep. And then the third thing that I loved about Robert Conrad in terms of what he did, of all things, and I don't know if any of you guys remember this, the Battle of the Network Stars. That's sort of competition, if you want to call it that. This is where the TV celebrities from ABC, CBS, and NBC would square off on teams, and they would race and have different competitions and play different types of sports and events to see who would come out ahead and who would come in second, who would come in third. It was awesome. Robert Conrad was typically the captain for NBC in a lot of those different competitions. And there are videos out there that I forgot about, but you can find them. I saw them. It brought back a lot of memories. There's videos out there of Robert Conrad, Gabe Kaplan, remember him from Welcome Back, Carter, and Telly Savalas. All three of them are captains for the three major networks. And while they're competing in these videos and going at it, two of them, you see them smoking on screen right before and right after the competitions or the races or whatever they were doing. The announcer for this, by the way, of this Network of the Stars or Battle of the Network of the Stars was Howard Cosell. So like you had just sort of a who's who of late 70s, early 80s in the sports and TV world. Pretty cool to check the Battle of the Network Stars episodes out. It'll bring back a lot of memories. Sadly, you know, Robert Conrad did almost kill another driver in a DUI incident later in his life. So, you know, not a perfect individual, but someone who's recently passed away over the past couple of years. Somebody I think we can look back on his work and really appreciate it from a time gone by. That's all we've got for episode 42. I hope you're well, and I hope you stay well until next week when we'll catch up on episode 43. Take care.